friend, I guess I misunderstood. Thought that we had mutual respect. Now I see the times that we get. So be careful who you choose as your friends, for they might let you down in the end. Just when I thought a real good friend I found, they pick you up and let you down. Yeah. Them let you down, down. It's better an open enemy. A false friend is the hardest thing to see. Cause when times are good, well, our friends are plenty. In times of trouble, well, not one in 20. Just when I thought a real good friend I found, to pick you up, to let you down. We were friends, we were friends. Real good friends, we were friends.
Oh, yeah. Stephen Marley, we friends, son of Bob Nestor Marley, with False Friends. This is Utrecht Lee. I forgot my name for a minute there. This is Lee Stories. I'm Utrecht Lee. It's Monday, October the 22nd, 2012, the day of the third and final face-off between President Barack Obama and his Republican challenger, Mitt Romney, former governor of Massachusetts. Polls are showing that they're now in a virtual dead heat for the nation's top job. Tonight, of course, you know that the third face-off occurs at Lynn University in Boca Raton, Florida, and Bob Schieffer, host of CBS's Face the Nation, will moderate the so-called debate. The candidates are expected to discuss five key foreign policy areas tonight: America's role in the world, hotbed regions such as Afghanistan and Pakistan, increasing tensions between Israel and Iran, the changing political landscape of the Middle East, and the rise of China as a superpower. Well, of course, you know we're going to be talking about the debate, as we have with all of the other so-called debates that have occurred. And you do know that that's your homework assignment tonight, to watch it and look at it or listen to it with a very practiced eye or ear. But we should talk a bit about foreign policy, U.S. foreign policy today. And a very curious thing happens when you take a look at foreign policy initiatives undertaken by the United States in the last several years, in fact, going back to the 1800s. And you see such a startling parallel to how policies, foreign policies, are formed and executed and implemented. But more so, you see what informs these policies? What is the basis for these policies? And it is mind-boggling how similar the policy-making strategy is today to that of yesteryear. Remarkable sameness. Remarkable genesis, if you will. Remarkable underpinning philosophy. We hear a lot these days about American exceptionalism. They invent words, okay? They've got to invent some kind of a word to rationalize extremely irrational concepts. So this one is exceptional. The notion of exceptionalism, American exceptionalism, and people are talking about it and using the phrase as if, you know, it's a great thing. As if only America is entitled to feel exceptional. Well, the world is made up of a whole bunch of other countries that feel equally exceptional, and that is the first one of the first things that you notice in the way Americans communicate this notion to the world. I talked to somebody just this afternoon who had this global perspective on the world, with all the righteousness and all the due, the patriotism, super patriotism, and I think it's a good thing to feel patriotic about one's country. But the person who was expressing all these thoughts about the rest of the world doesn't even have a passport. So this person has not even traveled beyond the borders of the United States. And I strongly suspect not even beyond the borders of the borough in which he lived. And yet he was waxing philosophic about how the rest of the world ought to behave and the position the United States should have and does have and has a right to have vis-a-vis the other countries of the world. Now, again, as I said, this is a person with a global perspective who doesn't have a passport, has never traveled, has never seen beyond the United States, has no idea about the cultures of the United States internally or how it's seen externally. And that right there is, in a way, the kind of blind cultural hegemony that we see associated with this notion of exceptionalism, American exceptionalism. It is an automatic right to not just be in the community of countries, but to dominate, to overrun, overshadow, overtake, to be the king of the hill on top of the heap, as the song says. And if you come at the world that way, you will formulate your policies that way. That is what is going to inform your, quote, patriotism, unquote. And the interesting thing, of course, is it is so narcissistic. You see that only you are entitled to feel this way. Only you are entitled. So this American exceptionalism goes back a long way, and it's tied to this idea that America, and only America, is destined. Its destiny is to convert the rest of the world to the true meaning of democracy. I can't wait to see it here at home. But somehow there's this messianic and missionary attitude that this country, of all countries on the planet, has been ordained almost by a divine hand to spread, quote, democracy, unquote, to the rest of the world. And its authority to do so derives from its exceptionalism. And then we see how U.S. foreign policy has been shaped on the basis of the same flaw that remains a permanent thread in the fabric of American life, and that is racism. Isn't it odd that as you examine U.S. foreign policy, and especially that kind of foreign policy that also gives rise to warmongering, military action, military intervention, they now call it, or military policing. All of this is happening in many ways in countries described as third world countries. Black and brown people, yellow people. America tends not to get careless about military intervention in European countries. It tends not to be casual about incurring the wrath of European countries. It doesn't give a damn about what people of color think when they visit all kinds of misery and heartache by way of war and warfare on other countries. And this, too, is a long-standing aspect of U.S. foreign policy. We had capitalism. It was like, you know, the comic book, the forces of capitalism meet the forces of communism, but always in somebody else's country. They fight and they bomb and they murder and kill and do all this stuff in somebody else's country. It's like the African saying, when two elephants fight, it's the grass that loses. And so we have had East and West behaving equally nastily by selecting other people's countries in which to misbehave. And in that regard, they're very much alike in the approach taken to this notion of foreign policy. And then we have what always has been part of foreign policy from time immemorial. And that is, if we see what we want in somebody else's country, because of course now we are exceptional, we can just go and get it. So foreign policy is informed by what do we need from somebody else's country that we can get by force? We just dispatch our army and our navy and our air force and our special ops and tanks and bombs and whatever else we have to do to go get it. A good example of that would be, I'd say, the war in Vietnam. Now, of course, we're told that the war in Vietnam was a classic case of good versus evil, capitalism versus communism, typically, again, both sides, the East and West, deciding a good place to fight it out is in Vietnam. But it wasn't an ideological war at all. It was the war fought for resources. Vietnam, among other things, was one of the world's largest producers of latex, rubber. And if you have, as America does, an auto industry, and the auto industry wouldn't go very far without tires, and you don't grow rubber plants in the United States, so you can't make tires in the U.S., and it therefore becomes a matter of national security to secure a steady supply. So you go and get it. France tried to do it, and they repelled France. And the United States said, France ain't nothing. They don't have our kinds of bombs. They don't have our bullets. They don't have our military might. We'll go and get it. So under the color of something else happening in Vietnam, the issue was, here is a good way to lay our claim, or stake our claim to a steady supply of rubber for tires. It's not the first time this has happened. Countries regularly cause a lot of heartache for other countries if they believe that those countries have something that they want. They just go and get it, like Columbus. Just go out there, Dominus vobiscum, go out there with your three ships, you have our permission to murder and pillage and rape and do whatever else you want to do. Just bring back the goodies. The basis of all power, the basis of all nationhood, is land, the acquisition of land. And that's why the British Empire was so proud that as a little tiny island, the sun never set on its assets. It owned entire continents. And that's a form of foreign policy. Some countries just want the land because when you have the land, you have what's on it, you have what's under it, you have what's in it, you have what's over it, and if you do this right, you also have what's around it. So you go after land, and you annex that land and the resources of that land. So don't forget, Vietnam was not an ideological war. It wasn't the first time that Detroit was bailed out. Sometimes foreign policy, U.S. foreign policy, resembles a Western movie. The gunslinger comes to town and he shoots and aims later. He just shoots up the joint. Why? Well, because he can. And to serve notice to whoever's in the town that I am the power, you will fear me. Sometimes foreign policy is about fear. Just plain, raw, undiluted fear. Now, fear has been a huge motivator in foreign policy matters, especially when those countries are described as third world countries. Everybody would know automatically that such countries aren't nearly equipped to defend themselves. They don't have an army and an air force and a navy and the bombs and bullets. They don't have soldiers. They don't have anything of a defense mechanism that could compare with the military juggernaut that the United States is. And rather than see that as even greater reason to engage in diplomacy, rather than fear-based warfare, the choice very often is to choose the latter because there is a special plus that you get when you use fear as a reason to subjugate others. That's what the entire hemisphere has gone through. Just bouts and bouts and bouts of fear-based war making. You will fear me so that in the future, I just have to, you know, that when you were a kid, you misbehave and your parent didn't have to actually physically get to you. They just had to look. Sometimes foreign policy is like that. You just give them a look. And everybody understands it and gets in line. It's a way of intimidating people, but it is a great formula for success. It's worked very, very successfully as a foreign policy initiative. Sometimes foreign policy, almost all the time, foreign policy reflects an extraordinary lack of understanding of just humanity, a lack of understanding of what real culture is and how you relate to people. Because the end result really is fear and intimidation. We do not see many instances of diplomacy being motivated by the desire to live as a good neighbor to really generate a wonderful bilateral relationship. It's got to have a cudgel, because that is deep in the American psyche. Fear, war, aggression. These are very American traits. And because it is an exceptional country, it is also the purveyor of exceptional levels of fear and aggression. Exceptionalism exists in that department as well. You are an exceptional intimidator, an exceptional aggressor, an exceptional military power that uses that very force to subjugate, to control, to even annihilate. Sometimes, and almost always, as I've said before, foreign policy is shaped, if you look at it very closely, by the same racist principles that exist domestically. The same notions. Like I said, I'm talking to this guy. He has never been anywhere. He doesn't have a passport. And yet he felt perfectly at ease telling me about the cultures of places he had never been, that he'd never experienced. And he is, in his head, fully informed to make a judgment about other cultures. That also is the way that you see, in many cases, U.S. foreign policy looks like that. A kind of open contempt for other cultures. Because it is not about the U.S. making an effort to understand other people. Romney openly said that maybe that is basically kowtowing and apologizing. To take a civilized position is to be weak. You must dominate, and you must do so even before they see you. They must fear you. And it comes out of the racist notion, a race-based notion, that as a white person in the United States, and that's who makes our foreign policy, nobody else makes our foreign policy, the automatic assumption of privilege, the automatic assumption of superiority, not just superiority, supremacy that is practiced domestically is exported in the form of diplomacy and foreign policy. And it doesn't matter who the president is. It is the mentality that remains remarkably the same. It doesn't matter who the president is. I want you to listen to a very interesting lecture. We don't have time for the entire lecture today, but I'd like you to listen to this. I found it quite interesting and quite instructive. You'd be hearing Michael Scheuer. He's an author. He's a former CIA operative. In fact, he was a former head of the CIA's Bin Laden unit. And he's talking here about what very often shapes U.S. foreign policy. He gave this talk that you're about to hear an excerpt of, a pretty nice chunk of it, on February the 12th, 2009. And even though some of the references may be dated, you know, in terms of the chronological dating, listen to how pertinent the issues are. He gave his talk at Dickinson College, and it was part of that college's forum on contemporary issues. I want you to listen now to Michael Scheuer when we are through with that, we'll take a break, and then we come back in our good ways and we start talking to each other about what we've just heard. Listen now.
I published a book entitled Marching Toward Hell, America and Islam After Iraq. As were my earlier books, Marching Toward Hell is meant to acquaint Americans with the nature of the threat they face from Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, and the Islamists they lead and incite. And again, as in my previous work, I argue in this book that the United States government is fighting an Islamist enemy that does not exist. Washington's Islamist enemy is the stuff of a Hollywood farce. A limited band of fanatic nihilists, ready to kill widely and indiscriminately for the pure joy of murdering, and ready to sacrifice their lives because my daughters go to university. People in Iowa hold early presidential primaries every 4 years, and because I, may God forgive me, have one or more Canadian Club and sodas after work. Would that such an enemy existed, for he would be at most a lethal nuisance and not the national security threat posed today by the Islamist movement that is symbolized and inspired by bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. This farcical view of America's Islamist enemy is unfortunately endemic in the U.S. political parties, much of the U.S. Western media, and almost all of the academy. It is my assessment that this view is almost entirely without substantiation. And if it continues to be the working assumption of the U.S. government, America will be slowly but surely defeated through the loss of prestige, blood, financial solvency, and domestic political cohesion. We will lose not because the enemy is militarily stronger than we are. That certainly is not the case. Indeed, America's myopic governing elite have taken an enemy who in military capability is at most a puny 4'7", even in high-heeled sandals, and made him into a 10-foot and still growing behemoth. Why has this happened? It has happened because America's bipartisan governing elite are rank and reckless interventionists. From President Bush to President Obama, from Speaker Pelosi to Mayor Giuliani, from Vice President Cheney to Vice President Biden, from the New York Times to the Washington Times, and from Fox News to National Public Radio, America's leaders, left, center, and right, believe that there is no problem, war, revolution, ethnic conflict, crooked election, jailed female poet, or religious clash that does not require direct American involvement. And this, whether or not a single genuine U.S. national interest is at risk or can even be identified. And it is in this relentless interventionism that we find the real motivation of America's Islamist enemies, as well as the organizational glue that provides that diverse movement with an always fragile cohesion. The Islamist motivation is to be found in their perception of U.S. foreign policy as an attack on the Islamic religion and its followers, a view that is held not only by those carrying AK-47s, but, if recent polling is accurate, nearly 80% of all Muslims worldwide. Now, no American must accept the Islamists' indictment of the anti-Muslim intent of U.S. foreign policy. But to avoid eventual defeat, U.S. leaders must acknowledge and then explain to the American people that this is indeed the Muslim world's perception, and that we all must accept that perception is always reality. And what are the policies that motivate the Islamists? I can do no better than to list the six U.S. policies Osama bin Laden enumerated in the fall of 1996 and has held closely to ever since. First, the U.S. military and civilian presence on the Arabian Peninsula. Second, the United States and Western exploitation of Muslim energy resources. Third, the U.S. military's presence in Muslim lands outside the Arabian Peninsula. Fourth, U.S. support for nations that oppress Muslims, especially Russia, China, and India. Fifth, unqualified U.S. support for Israel. And sixth, U.S. support and protection for Muslim tyrannies and police states. These six policies, then, form the core of the Islamist motivation for waging war against America. And while U.S. citizens can debate whether the policy status quo should be kept, or one or more of the policies should be changed or abandoned, it is likely that the maintenance of Washington's prevailing operating assumption that Muslims hate Americans for who we are and how we live, and not for what the U.S. government does in the Islamic world, will lead to nothing less than a vast and willful case of self-deception that will certainly yield calamity for the nation. In the United States today, as I'm sure you can imagine, the foregoing line of analysis is not in the mainstream. Indeed, it is more likely to be dismissed as pathological. And yet, 13 years after al-Qaeda declared war on America, the cynical act of political expediency in Iraq, known as the Surge, is unraveling. The war in Afghanistan is lost beyond recall. Pakistan is in genuine danger of going the way of Afghanistan. The Mujahideen bleed through from Iraq is visible in Jordan, Syria, Turkey, Lebanon, Palestine, and Israel. The Islamist insurgencies in Somalia and Algeria have been rekindled, with the Somalia Mujahideen nearing victory. Similar insurgencies of varying but building vitality are underway in southern Thailand, Mindanao, and the North Caucasus. The major cities of Hindu India are being attacked by Islamist fighters almost at will, and the Islamist movement in Western Europe is growing and, at least in Great Britain, has driven the traditionally stoic security services to the point of public despair. As for the United States, bin Laden has delineated al-Qaeda's war aims for defeating America in three concise phrases. First, to bleed America to bankruptcy. Second, to spread out U.S. military and intelligence forces to sap their flexibility and their reserves. And third, to undermine domestic unity in the United States as much as possible. Given these three war aims to use as a metric, I will leave it to the audience to decide whether there is any reason for Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda to be discouraged about the amount of progress they have made in the war they began in 1996. Now let me move to the second part of this talk by suggesting that the best foreign policy advice for the new Obama administration, in fact for every U.S. administration, has been heard by anyone who has flown on a civilian airliner. During the pre-flight security briefing, each passenger is told that in the case of an emergency, place your own oxygen mask on first, and only then help others with theirs. I referred to this common sense instruction in Marching Toward Hell. I believed in its pertinence to U.S. foreign policy then. I believe that it is even more pertinent today. Before America and the precious few of our allies who are able and willing to fight can defeat the expanding Islamist movement, and beat it we must, and with as much military power as needed, and certainly far more than we have used to date, the U.S. government must first put its own political and foreign policy houses in order. America can help no alliance partner or other foreign nation until it is re-anchored in its own history and traditions. And to do that, we must return to the design of the government crafted by General Washington and the other founders. Indeed, until such a reordering occurs, America cannot even help itself. In foreign policy, the key to this reanchoring is a return to an independent and non-interventionist foreign policy. If there be one principle more deeply rooted in the mind of every American, Thomas Jefferson wrote in 1791, it is that we should have nothing to do with conquest. In America's war with Islamism, we are losing because our bipartisan governing elite and its academic and media apologists have turned Mr. Jefferson on his head, much to the nation's detriment. Once elected, the leaders of both parties automatically and often mindlessly intervene in the affairs of other nations and regions. If you doubt this, recall last weekend's speech by Vice President Biden in Europe, in which he claimed the United States would make common cause with European nations who feel threatened by Russia. No nation had called for a public declaration, thus fulfilling the automatic part, and Biden's pledge just came as Washington had fatally given Moscow control over our major non-Pakistani resupply routes into Afghanistan for U.S. and NATO forces, thus meeting the equation's mindless requirement in spades. Such knee-jerk interventionism has been the hallmark of U.S. policy in the Muslim world since at least 1973. And its main objective has been to create, its main achievement has been to create a slate of policies that leaves us with few options in the region and all but guarantees endless wars with Muslims. Foreign policy is, of course, about creating options for use in protecting genuine national interests. But when Americans celebrated Independence Day last July, in the midst of a presidential election year, neither Senator Obama nor Senator McCain had the moral courage to tell Americans the truth, which is that over the last 35 years, both parties have consciously eviscerated U.S. independence on the single most important policy issue, the decision on whether or not to go to war. Both parties, for example, have failed to move the United States to energy security since the first Saudi-led embargo, in 1973. Instead of freeing the U.S. economy from the Arab-held dagger pointed at its heart, American presidents, Republican and Democrat, have unmanfully groveled and begged for more oil from their energy-producing masters in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and other Arab states. The same presidents have so enormously overspent the public treasury that America is now further in the thrall of the same Arab tyrants who, with China, buy an ever-increasing portion of our debt. Because of such leadership, Americans will find they have lost the control over the decision of whether to go to war. If anti-Saudi unrest in the kingdom's eastern province ever seriously curtails oil production, U.S. soldiers and Marines will automatically deploy to defend and secure the Saudi police state and to restore oil production. And the reality of automatic war for oil goes beyond the Arab world. By 2012, the United States will import 20% of its crude from the Niger Delta. If production in that region, which is already beset by a growing insurgency, is ever significantly reduced, soldiers and Marines will automatically be deployed there to restore production. And if you think the insurgencies in Iraq and Afghanistan are nightmares, just wait until U.S. forces are fighting in 27,000 square kilometers of swamp and forest. America also has lost control of the peace or war decision because its leaders in both parties have involved them almost inextricably in the unending and unendable war between Arabs and Israelis. Ignoring and even ridiculing the founders' explicit guidance to avoid getting involved in other people's wars, both parties not only have involved us in the Middle East, but there have involved us in other people's religious wars. Can there be any better definition of an insane foreign policy than the one that today finds the United States not only involved to the hilt in other people's religious wars, but backing both of the major antagonists in that war, Israel and Saudi Arabia. By being the cash cow for and the unquestioning protector of Israel, and the only protector of the fundamentally anti-American Saudi state, Washington has created a situation in which America will be drawn into any Arab-Israeli war that includes any Arab state beyond Palestine, no matter what the wishes or the interests of the American people. Having thus all but negated the ability of the United States to abstain from wars for oil and major wars between Arabs and Israelis, The U.S. political elite has completed its axis of doom for Americans through their apparently limitless zeal for overseas democracy crusading. A perversion of what America stands for that can only lead to war and more war. The American elite's democracy crusading in Iraq has destabilized the entire Near East region, creating new threats to oil supplies and making their price almost entirely unpredictable. It also has cost American taxpayers nearly $1 trillion and killed more than 4,200 of their soldier children and wounded 32,000 more. A few more such missions accomplished in the democracy-building realm will bankrupt our nation. And the still pending threat of another war to impose democracy, this time in Iran, which is, of course, a more representative regime than any of Washington's Islamo-fascist Arab allies, would be a negative achievement of Homeric proportions. War on Iran would be billed as a war to liberate oppressed Iranians or to stop the spread of nuclear weapons, but in reality, it would be like the war in Iraq, nothing more than a war to protect Israel. Such a war, moreover, might well temporarily unite the Muslim world, 1.4 billion Muslims, if you're counting, in a jihad against the United States. If any additional proof is needed of the ingrained lust of American politicians to intervene where no U.S. interests are at risk, just recall that President Obama and Senator McCain both took time out of their campaigns last summer to praise and welcome the independence of Kosovo, thereby helping the quite mad Europeans light the fuse to the next Balkans war. And later in the summer, both men paused again after Russia invaded Georgia to urge the rapid admission of Georgia to NATO, apparently eager to give the Georgians the same sort of unredeemable and war-causing security guarantee that Great Britain gave to Poland in 1939. America's bipartisan governing elite then, with the support of the media and the academy, has brought the United States face to face with war at every turn. Wars over oil, wars over the religious conflicts in which no genuine U.S. national interest is at stake, and wars to impose secular democracy on people who will fight it to the death. This situation is surely the antithesis of what the founders intended when they designed a constitutional system meant to limit the chance of arbitrary government that inevitably leads to tyranny. The founders knew, and contemporary Americans are painfully learning, that there are a few better definitions of tyranny than one that finds an entire nation repeatedly led into wars where no national interests are at risk because of the personal beliefs, ambitions, or even whims of a single individual, be he or she a monarch, a dictator, or a popularly elected president and his closest advisors. To have a chance of defeating America's Islamist enemies, U.S. leaders must begin to give up their half-century binge of interventionism and begin to build a viable American republic to replace America's already collapsing attempt at empire. The question is, of course, how to begin to retrieve the blank check war commitments U.S. leaders have given to foreigners.
Just when I thought everything was good, my friend, I guess I misunderstood. Thought that we had love and respect, but now I see the times that we get. So I'm careful who I choose as my friends, for they might let I down in the end. Just a thought, when I thought, when I thought.
Okay, 888-874-4888 is the number to call to be part of this conversation on Lead Stories right here on PRN.FM, 1-888-874-4888. Now, you heard our speaker, Michael Scheuer, make mention of Iran. He was speaking 3 years ago and laying out a scenario, and what do we have? We have the focus being Iran. We had Benjamin Netanyahu come to the UN General Assembly meeting and make a big thing about Iran and how the U.S. has got to get involved, and what we need is a war, essentially. We need to take preemptive action, and he laid it out. Who is Michael Scheuer? He's a former CIA intelligence officer. He is a historian. He's a foreign policy critic and political analyst. He's an adjunct professor at Georgetown University's Center for Peace and Security Studies. And for 22 years, he worked with the CIA and served as the chief of the Bin Laden Issue Station from 1996 to 1999. So he gives a pretty interesting view. Now, I don't agree necessarily with everything, but it's instructive. It is eye-opening when the whole issue of foreign policy in the Middle East is cast in this particular light, that it is not about Muslims hating the United States. It's about them having a particular strategy. And it is about the United States insisting on becoming, he called it, let me see, I took my notes here. He said, interventionist, relentlessly and recklessly interventionist in areas in which we have no direct interest. And yet, how much of our money has gone into these proxy wars for aims and objectives that are not clear, certainly clearly not in our interest, and yet billions and billions of dollars have been spent. 1-888-874-4888. It is always important to consider all kinds of views because they have something to suggest. JJ, you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon, Yuchi.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, I was very impressed with the program today because as a U.S. Army veteran and a world traveler, I've often went into U.S. embassies all over the world, Burundi, you know, you name it, Caribbean, Europe, all over. And I was very surprised to see no representation of myself in these embassies.
Well, that's a whole other subject, but it's related. It's related. What struck you most about what you heard today?
Well, basically, the new communism, which is the war on Islam, basically, that's really what I heard, indirectly but directly.
Go ahead, I'm listening.
And, you know, myself as a pastor and a listener to progressive radio for over 40 years, I'm very interested in where my vote goes and where my tax dollar goes in direct relationship to the education that I receive from you on your shows historically and traditionally, and being very analytical of what the Washington Republican or Dixiecrat or Democrats say they represent and how they're using my tax dollar domestically and internationally. It really affects me as a citizen of this country who also have dual citizens in Jamaica, West Indies. I find that when I go...
Oh, I'm so sorry. We seem to have lost you. Oh, we seem to have lost him. I'm sorry about that. Ron from Queens, are you on?
Hey, how you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Okay. Yeah, I was. I did call in to talk about the policy. It seems to me that that we seem to be following the sloppy house policy. You know, like you get one party in, to clean up the war that the last party had. They go 8 years, and then they argue about who started the policy. You know, and it's a never-ending thing. It continues to go on and on. But I do believe that this is all about money. And the money as a controlling instrument, or a currency as a control, you know, because Iran, it's oil. But it's not really oil. It's the petrodollar. Iraq, same thing. Libya was a little different because they wanted to have a gold currency. But it always seems to be about who is controlling the currency or the power, you know, in that way.
And tonight, when you watch this debate, having heard what we shared here today, I know you would be listening with a very different ear, especially because this very question will become a major focus of the so-called foreign policy debate. And it was instructive, I think, to hear this view about it. I think so. So thank you so much for calling. We're kind of close to our time. I just wanted to thank you for your calls. We'll continue this discussion tomorrow because, you know, the homework is to watch the debate. Could we take another call? Let's see. What's the verdict? We have time for another call? Yes, we do. Alan from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Hello, Lutrice.
Hello.
Lutrice, how are you?
Fine, thank you. You
well,
got to make it fast.
I haven't come to any definite solutions from last week's conversation, but I tell you, Obama and Romney, I don't think they could change much at all because I don't think they are the actual leaders of the country. I believe it's the powers behind them. I think it was Eisenhower that said before he left the office, beware of the military-industrial complex. Now, I believe that those are the powers that be. And if you're going to ask me for a solution, God knows I don't have one.
No, I'm going to ask you to watch tonight and report tomorrow what your findings were, especially in light of this discussion that we are having today and this bit of information, this little primer that we had the privilege of hearing today. Thanks, Alan, for calling.
Okay, take care. Have a good one.
Thank you so much. Well, that really does bring us to the end of the program. We would be talking tomorrow at length. We're picking up on today's program, and of course we're adding to it our observations about this debate, the final one in the showdowns of the so-called debates. Stay tuned. You want to stay tuned. Coming up next is, let's see, who's coming up next? Richard Martin with Wake Up Call. Thank you. You can call me and you can write me at leadstories@gmail.com. Thank you. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye. Just when I thought, real good friend I found.